With our special guest tonight, Julian Cribb, as we talk about the coming famine. So get ready for that. Back with more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Julian, what do you mean by peak phosphorus? What does that mean?
Well, phosphorus is the most important element on the planet in one sense, in that no living creature can survive without it, right? No microbe, no human, no elephant, no horse, no nothing. They all depend on phosphorus as an essential element in our cells. Phosphorus is a major ingredient in the fertilizers that grow our food, and it is part of the secret of the success of modern agriculture. That's what's actually doubled the world's population, is the food that we've been able to produce with the phosphorus and nitrogen. Now, phosphorus is like oil. It occurs in deposits, and like oil, those deposits can be mined out, and they can become much more expensive and difficult to mine as demand goes up. And that's the issue, that if the world runs out of phosphorus, there is nothing that you can use to replace it. If we run out of oil, well, we can find some other source of energy, but there is nothing that replaces phosphorus. So that's a real concern. And there is a likelihood that phosphorus is going to get very scarce and very expensive over the coming 20 or 30 years, and that the countries that control it will reserve it for their own farmers and they'll refuse to sell it to others. And we're already actually starting to see that.
Now, when we talk about providing food for people, how do we also know, though, that we're going to provide quality, healthy food? I mean, it's not like we're going to get all these cheeseburgers and give them to people, is it?
No, well, unfortunately, the modern Western diet kills half its consumers. It's not that healthy. An awful lot of people nowadays die as a result of their diet. And so there is an argument that says that if you eat a little lighter, you're going to live a little longer. And also, if you eat a little lighter, you're probably going to be able to protect the world food supply as well. And that's essentially what humanity has got to do. That's our own personal contribution to solving this problem, is that we need to eat in ways that are not going to tread so heavy on the planet that they threaten us. And we're also going to have to eat in ways that are not going to give us cancer or heart disease or diabetes or stroke or obesity.
Now, as you look at this program, what are governments starting to do now? As you talked about, this is not a problem for at least 40 years unless there's regional catastrophes. How many people have that attitude, Julian, of, hey, that's 40 years from now. I'm not going to worry about it.
Yeah, well, a lot of people do, and of course, politics is driven by opinion polls, and they change in the blink of an eye, and so politicians are not focused on this. I believe that actually politicians in China are focused on it, because they know if they can't feed their huge population, they're in an awful lot of trouble. So I think that China probably, of all the governments of the world, has the most realistic understanding of this issue. I'm seeing, academics and strategic thinkers and so on starting to talk about it, but the average government doesn't have a clue, to be honest with you, and that's the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. As you were putting together the book, The Coming Famine, what was for you the most frightening aspect that you came across?
Well, I suppose the most frightening aspect was that we could just sit around and assume that there would be food forever and ever and do nothing about it, and that we would lose, our water, our land, our farmers, and so on. It was the thought that we might actually be killed by our own complacency was the most bothersome aspect. So, the book is a wake-up call. It says we can solve this problem. It's going to be, possible to fix this problem, but not without a great deal of focus and effort and investment. And we need all of those things.
What about fish? What's going on with the ocean seas?
Yeah, well, the scientists tell us that 29% of the world's fisheries have already collapsed, and the other ones, if we don't fix them up, are going to collapse as well. There are some encouraging signs that we can manage our fisheries better, but it basically means that that little piece of fish on your plate is going to get very, very expensive as fish becomes much more scarce. And let me sort of illustrate this. If we currently eat about 100 million tons of fish from the oceans, if we can't double that fish catch, and almost nobody that I know in the science of fish thinks that we can double it, then we're going to have to produce 100 million tons of meat from land animals or from farmed fish. To produce 100 million tons of meat from land animals is going to require 1 billion tons of grain. And that's going to require 1,000 cubic kilometres of water. And if you add that to the natural growth in meat demand that is going to occur as Chinese consumers, you know, buy more meat, as Indian consumers buy more meat and so on, we would actually have to find three more North Americas to grow the grain to feed that many animals. So you can see this is just a way of expressing the scale of the problem. So we're obviously going to have to think up some other ways to produce food that sort of don't involve growing grain and shoving it into animals.
As much as the title makes it sound like it's the end for all of us, you actually have a positive outcome to this story.
Yeah, I'm an optimist. I believe, you know, we solved the global food crisis in the 1960s with the Green Revolution. We can do it again, but it's not going to be the same solution. We do need a lot more science and technology. And let me say this. At the moment, the world's investment in agricultural science and technology is disgraceful. It's about $40 billion, which is almost nothing. I imagine that's a very small thing, even in the budget of California. Currently, we are spending every year $1,500 billion on armaments. So the spending of the world on weapons is 50 times larger than the spending of the world on securing the food supply. Now, we discussed earlier how food is vital to peace. If you don't have enough of it, you have war. If you have enough of it, you have a good chance of peace. So I actually argue that we should be reinvesting some of our defense money in peacemaking through agriculture. Jimmy Carter, former U.S. president, used to say this, that hungry people are not peaceful people, and that you know, if you can secure a food supply, you reduce the chances of conflict. So this would make a very sensible way of reducing the tensions in the world.
Can we make the deserts fertile?
It's going to be hard to make them fertile because I'm saying that the actual, you know, the ingredients, the phosphorus and the nitrogen are running out, or that they may be limited and expensive in future unless we start recycling them. If we recycle the nutrients out of our cities, we can take them to the deserts. Yes, there are techniques for even using salt water in solar-powered greenhouses and growing crops. Yes, indeed, we can do that. But again, it takes money, and so far, you know, the economic signals for agriculture tend to be: don't invest here. You can make more money somewhere else.
Give me the steps that you would undertake to start fixing this problem.
Okay, well, I think the first one is to make people aware of it, that we have to change the way we farm and to change the way we the diet, the food that we choose. We're going to need to have to educate the people. I would like to see a year of food taught in every primary school on the planet, every junior school on the planet, in which every subject is taught through the lens of food. So when you study math, you know, all the examples are related to food. When you study science, you learn how plants grow and animals grow. When you study sport, you learn what's a healthy diet. When you study geography, you study, you know, where food is grown, where it comes from. Because in the future, we're going to have 8 billion people living in cities with no idea where their food comes from. And if we don't teach them where their food comes from, and then we don't teach them to respect it, this waste will go on and on. And at the moment, as I say, we're throwing away half our food, which is a really silly thing to do. Our grandparents would not approve of it. You know, they would tell us we were stupid, and they'd be right. So we've got to start bringing back the respect that we had for food in the past, because otherwise, if we don't, you know, it will become scarce.
Well, and we're going to want to eat healthy. That's the important thing. I mean, people need to learn stay off sugars and all these other things.
Yeah, and you know, one way that we could eat healthy, I was in Africa not so long ago, and they told me they had more than 400 different vegetables that I in the Western world had never even heard of, you know. So there's a real adventure to be had here, a culinary adventure. If we eat more vegetables in our diet, it will reduce the amount of energy that we're using to grow our food, the amount of water, the amount of land. You could grow vegetables in the cities, on the roofs of buildings, on the sides of buildings, underneath buildings, using recycled water and nutrients from the city. And this will protect the city against food shortages, and it will give people a much healthier diet because they will have fresh vegetables, you know, so eating a little less meat and a little less dairy and the high energy foods, and then they will have a little less disease as well as a result, and they'll be a little less obese.
What do you think of eating seeds and nuts, Julian?
Yeah, you need those. They're high in protein, and that's an important component of the diet. So we need to have the balanced diet, but I also think we need to eat probably about 50% more vegetables than we're eating at the moment. I'm not advocating vegetarianism. I believe it's free choice with food. If you still want to eat beef, you must eat beef or lamb, but it's going to be very expensive, and you're going to eat it like it was caviar.
Will you find that as more and more people starve, the heart disease rate goes down because they're not eating bad food? They're not eating at all.
I don't know whether the rate goes down when people starve, but countries which are hungry or which have a very light diet have much less heart disease. So societies that tend to have this kind of healthy, natural, farm-based diet have much less degenerative disease generally. They have lower rates of cancer, lower rates of heart disease, and certainly they don't have obesity.
Are all countries aware of this potential problem?
Some are more aware than others. I mean, those that are closer to hunger are more aware of it than others. But I don't think that people have understood where it could lead. That's the important point. That's what the military thinkers are contributing here. They're saying, do you realize if we don't fix this, we will get wars and we will get, migrations of hundreds of millions of people, which will be very hard to control.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so. We're going to take phone calls with you shortly, Julian. Lots of folks want to get some more answers to what is a perplexing situation indeed. What's the United Nations doing?
Well, the United Nations has been warning about these things through its Food and Agriculture Organization for some time, and they've, broadly speaking, been ignored.
Hmm. Why?
Well, I think it was a message people didn't want to hear. I think that food problems, especially in rich societies like ours, we tend to think, famine is something that happens in another continent far away and it doesn't touch us. I'm saying the world is now so interconnected that it will touch us, and that's why we should take a personal interest in it. So I think that, things have changed in the last 20 or 30 years from what they were in the past.
Do you ever see the time where the Chinese will send their billions flooding into the United States, wars, because they want our land?
What is happening is that China is already, and its agriculture department admitted this a year or two ago, they're already investing in farmland in other countries, same way that they're investing in oil and gas.
And I'm sure here, too.
Yes, and the other thing that I've noticed, and I haven't heard anyone else comment on this, but there are enormous quantities of young Chinese coming over to study in other countries and then applying for residency and permanence and things like that. So that didn't happen 10 years ago. The communist government kept all its citizens, behind the border. Now it's saying to them, go. I suspect that China is trying to reduce its own population by emigration. Because they know that they've got major water shortages and potential food shortages down the line.
Are they having a brain drain, though, by doing that?
I think they've got so many brains that they can probably afford to let a few of them go.
Maybe so. Maybe so, indeed. Biggest problem today, right now, you would say is what?
At the moment, probably what I would define as the underinvestment in international agricultural research. We've just allowed it to die. And that means the farmers are driving into a big technology pothole. They're not going to get the science and the technology that they need to double world food production. So if we started reinvesting tomorrow, that would really help matters. But as I say, we need the education. We need the cities to start thinking sustainably and reusing water and nutrients. All of these things have to happen. And redesigning a city doesn't just take a few years. It takes a decade or two. So that's why I'm saying we now need to start thinking about it now.
Are you a supporter of GM or genetically modified foods?
Yeah, I don't really take a position on this. I think the world is going to need every good technology it can get to increase food production, and even then we'll find it difficult. GM, I know people think that they're worried that it's controlling the food supply and things like that, and that is a concern. If they start patenting important food genes and, like the genes for drought resistance in crops that we might need, under climate change, then that's a serious issue. On the other hand, you could possibly modify crops in a way so that they use less fertilizer and less water and less energy to produce them. So that might actually help poorer farmers. So, I don't have an ideological position on GM. I think we need all the technologies we've got. We need to be doing all the different kinds of science. But if I could add one area where we really need to do science, that's soil microbiology. Mm-hmm. We need to understand the living organisms in the soil that dictate the fertility and which control the carbon cycle. We need to be able to manage those much better. There, I believe, we can massively increase food production.
What is going to happen with the population? Do you advocate? And could we make it now if we only had 2 billion people on the planet?
Yeah, 2 billion people would be perfect, and they could all live like, an upper-middle-income American.
Forever.
Yeah, that would be perfectly sustainable. And realizing that is an important part of this. And like I mentioned earlier, young women are not marrying and they're not having children. I think that they are sensing that overpopulation is going to be a major problem for our species. And they're pulling back from the brink. Even though governments throw money at parents and say, have more babies and things like that, they're not doing it. So there is hope in this, that the human race is actually coming to its senses and reducing. But you've got to do a lot of other things. If you want to drive down the population, you have to get rid of poverty, because poverty is the thing that causes people to overpopulate. Rich families have much fewer numbers of children. So, again, we have to look at how we share the wealth around the world to discourage population growth.
Well, I still think some sinister group somewhere, Julian, is going to come up with the plan and the idea for drastic population control.
Well, they probably will, and whether they can make it stick or not, I don't know, because for population control, you have to have a reasonable amount of support from the masses. And we saw what happened with China, that the city people obeyed the one-child policy and the rural people more or less ignored it. So, even a really, you're talking about a chemical or a biological method.
Absolutely. Right? Maybe you put it in a vaccine and don't tell people. Who knows? Who knows?
But that would be tantamount to declaring war on the human race. I mean, candidly, I believe these
but
things
is that,
can be solved.
Is that survival, though?
Yeah, it's survival. But wouldn't it be a shame if a species as intelligent as ours was reduced to doing things like that instead of doing them through, democratic means and consensus and the fact that we all agree that we ought to reduce our fertility and eat lighter?
Well, there's no question, though. Regardless of what we do with the food source and the food chain, and the production, there's no way we can support 10 billion people, is there?
I don't think so, but if you did recycle food through biocultures, as they're called, in other words, you just take your water and your nutrients, you put them straight in a big steel vessel, and you feed a population of microbes or plant cells or something like that, and you produce a nutritious sludge, you probably could feed an awful lot of people. But those people would be demanding other things. They'd still be wanting plasma TVs and mobile phones, and they'd be wanting metals and energy and so on. So you've got to, you'd have to provide all those other things for them.
Do you remember a movie called Soylent Green?
Yes, horrible movie, yeah.
Well, that's what we could come down to. There's an abundance of food right there, if you listen to the movie.
Yes. Well, one of the things that scares me, you asked what scared me, if you had a big city of 20 or 30 million people, and say Jakarta in Indonesia is due to have 37 million people by 2030, and that means Jakarta will have more people than Australia. If you had a city like that and the trucks didn't come, there is no doubt that kind of scenario might be played out.
I think so, too. Well, stay with us. We're going to take some phone calls with you, Julian, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking about his latest work, The Coming Famine. His websites are all linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. If you need to email me, well, that's easy, too. That's George at coasttocoastam.com. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel here with this coming famine? That's the big story. We'll take your phone calls, maybe even your stories where you've come across some very strange food crises in your own life. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're going to take some phone calls now with Julian Cribb right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with Julian Cribb. We'll take your phone calls this half hour as we talk about the coming famine, the global food crisis, and what we can do to avoid it. What can people do individually in order to start working on this now? Well, I've always talked about storing food and things like that. What do you think?
I don't think we need panic measures, but I think that we need to be much more conscious when we shop that we should eat lighter. That's for ourselves. We need to eat in a more healthy fashion. But we also need to think about how much water there is embodied in the food that we eat and how much oil is embodied in it. And we need to start choosing those foods that have a less dire impact, if you like, on the resources of the planet. I know there's not very much information around about this at the moment, but that information is going to come forward. And people will know. Hopefully you will be able to see on the packet of your foods how much water is embodied in that food or how much it's costing the environment to produce.
You are probably way ahead of your time on this, aren't you?
A little bit, I suspect. But look, I'm since the book came out, I have seen lots and lots of discussion on the internet among people who are, you know, slow foodies, people who are conscious, trying to change their diets, trying to grow their own food. There's a strong awareness building up in the population.
Let's go to the phones. We'll go east to the Rockies. Sean is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to kind of see what. Well, this is my take on it. The lack of interest in marriage and having kids in societies, I believe, is due to cultural brainwashing and basically chemical sterilization. It's a forced practice of eugenics on the masses that is reducing population, and I believe this is something the global elite have been pushing for and is achieving. And
how do you think they're doing it, Sean?
Well, they, through genetically modifying and through adding all these chemicals to our food and water supplies, we haven't been getting the proper nutrients for decades. And it's a big concern of mine. I'm only 21 years old, and I can see it happening, the dumbing down of the population on mass levels. And it's really terrible. Has me concerned for the future.
I'm proud of you to see this at the age of only 21. How did you start looking at this?
Well, honestly, once I learned about eugenics and everything, and through social planners and all this, globalism. I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous.
You're doing well.
But, you know, cheap food sells very easily to the poor masses.
True.
And when it's these big corporate companies with global, you know, they don't have any specific boundaries. They just go globally throughout the world, and they choose what's put into our food without really educating us about what is being put into our food.
All right. What's your reaction to this, Julian? Thanks for that call. He's only 21. That's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, there's certainly something in what he says, in that there's quite a lot of science now that says that the food that that we get in the cities is a lot less nutritious, than it was, 20 or 30 years ago, and B, than food that is just naturally grown, according to natural systems. And there's good British work on this, for example, showing that a tomato in the supermarket is probably only about a third as nutritious as a tomato grown, under natural conditions or organically grown. In other words, you've got to eat three tomatoes from the supermarket to get the same amount of nutrition, and that might explain why obesity is happening, because people are getting less nutrition and more bulk in their diet. As far as population is concerned, there's probably no worldwide plan on all of this. Different countries have different policies, and most countries do have policies that try to encourage families to have more babies, but those policies are not working. And I think they're not working really because, as I say, young women are finding other things to do with their lives than marry and have babies. And that's happening in all cultures. It's not just happening in the US and Australia. So you know, there is natural reduction. But the other thing that the Chorn said, which I think is important to pick up on, is the nature of the pollution that's going around the planet now. I mean, we're adding to the pollutants every single year. New chemicals and new elements are appearing in our consumer products, and we really do not know the long-term biological effects that these are having. But certainly, we know that some of them in combination can reduce fertility. You know, we'd have seen lowered sperm counts, but we don't know what the explanation is. It's like trying to explain cancer. But we do know these things are loose. There's 75,000 chemicals or something that are now in our environment. We're finding these things in the poles and the deep sea, so they're floating around the planet. They're everywhere. You take your mobile phone and things like that, it contains elements like tellurium and lanthanum and so on. These are metals, and most metals are poisonous. We simply don't know what effect they have on the human body in the long run if you're exposed to them. So there are a whole lot of questions there that really need scientific examination.
Okay, next up we go west of the Rockies in Bishop, California. It's David's turn. Hi, David, go ahead.
Hi, George and Julian, thank you.
Sure.
Julian, is there a push in Australia to eliminate heirloom seeds like what's happening here in America?
I wouldn't say that there's a push to eliminate them. Indeed, there are quite a lot of people who are very energetically breeding up heirloom seeds and searching for heirloom seeds. So there's a very strong collecting and conservation movement. What is of concern in Australia is that most of our plant breeding in this country is done in the public sector. In other words, it's done with taxpayers' money in state departments of agriculture. And that's now folding up at the knees. And it's all going over to, you know, a handful of large companies, most of whom are from America. And the problem for Australia is that, of course, seeds that grow well in America don't necessarily grow so well under Australian conditions, which are rather different. So the worry is that, you know, our seed supply will kind of get dominated by what you might call a generalized, you know, American or world germplasm, and we won't have those special varieties of crops that we need to survive in our own environment and ecosystems.
Very good. I'm an aquaponics small farmer, so George had mentioned something earlier about fish, and that includes fish raising and crop growing, and it supports itself. So I don't know if you wanted to talk to George about that or not, but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, next up we go to Denver, Colorado. First-time caller, Will's with us. Hi, Will.
Hi, George.
Hi.
I just had a quick question. I'd seen a video on the internet about a green algae food source that may have been used in the past, and NASA has been looking into it for space flight missions. I was just wondering if Julian had heard anything about that or anything to say about that.
Yeah, most certainly. I think that algae farming is going to be one of the major sources of oil to keep the tractors rolling, of food, of feed for animals in the future, because you can grow an awful lot more of these things off a relatively small area of water with algae, and you can feed those algae on the organic waste from your cities. So in other words, you can recycle the organic waste from the urban area into an algae farm, and you can use that algae farm to produce, as I say, food, feed, energy, pharmaceuticals, a whole range of things depending on the species of algae that you're farming. This kind of aquaculture, I think, is going to be one of the savers, actually.
You know, they're talking about blue-green algae, too. It's a great supplement these days.
Yeah, there are all kinds of algae. I mean, some of them are toxic, so you've got to be a bit careful what you're choosing. But, I mean, we're going to choose them with the same care that we choose our ordinary crop plants and pasture plants and livestock.
All right, next up we go to St. Paul. Vince, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Vince.
Good morning. I believe that there will be a food shortage, but not exactly the way this guest is describing it. He acts as if the people that hold the power want maybe to do food. I'm thinking that the food shortage would be...
Where'd you go?
Say again?
We lost you for a little bit.
Okay. I think that the food shortage is going to be purposely designed for a population, lowering of the population, and about countries that might have resources and they might protect the resources. I don't know if any country has any mineral rights or resources rights. I believe that all the resources, like the oil and the diamonds, are owned by families that rule the world. And so when a country acts as if they're going to defend their oil, well, actually, we're fighting for the big oil company.
Well, you know, the rich get rich, the poor get poor. What do you think of that, Julian?
Well, there's truth in this. The world supplies of potash are controlled primarily by Canada, and the world supplies of phosphorus are controlled primarily by Morocco and secondly by China, and China is already declining to share them because it needs it for its own farmers. But this problem is easily solved. As I say, you just need to harvest the nutrients that come out of the bottom end of your city. Instead of throwing food in landfill and instead of sending our sewage into the sea, we recycle the nutrients out of that, cleanse it and recycle it, and then we don't run out of those things. They don't become a strategic factor and a source of wars.
All right, next up we go to Fullerton, California. George is with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, George. Go ahead.
Hi. I had hatched salmon and steelhead eggs, and I could get 82% return out of the hatchery. But when they're done in the wild, you only get 2% return. So I think fish, salmon, and steelhead would be a viable resource. And you could also use that fish to make fish emulsion for fertilizer and use it for making fuel also.
Well, it's called innovation, I guess, Julian, isn't it?
Yeah, we farm salmon quite a lot in Australia, and that's it's a very good little industry, produces a beautiful product. The issue you have to bear in mind with farming fish is you need fresh, clean water, and the world is becoming short of fresh, clean water because of all the pollution that we're putting into it. If you put heavy metals into your water, then they're going to show up in the fish and poison your consumers. So that's point one. Point two is, what do you feed the fish on? If you feed them purely on trash fish, as we call it, from our fishing industry, it takes 5 tons of trash fish to produce 1 ton of salmon. So you're actually mining the oceans in order to support your farming operation, which again is not a good thing. If you feed them on grain, well, they're competing with the other livestock, with cattle and sheep and so on, for that grain. So, you've got to factor these things in. I mean, but fish are phenomenally efficient at converting feed into meat.
What did you mean by we're losing our brains?
I meant that we're not investing in agricultural science like we used to do. The advanced countries of the world spend 1.8 cents in every science dollar on food and 98 cents on something else. And that just shows you that they don't think food is an issue. It just tells you that they're not serious about it. The number of agricultural scientists that are doing work like the important work in the United States, in Australia, and around the world has gone down. They've been closing the research laboratories and shutting them down, closing faculties at university. They're not recruiting bright young people to this cause any longer, anything like the rates that we're going to need. And the result of that is that the farmers aren't going to get the technology that they need to lift production. So this is something that we really have to put the foot on the accelerator.
Well, and as long as they're eating, Julian, they probably won't do anything.
That's right. Well, in Western society, we're complacent because we don't see the need because we've got food coming out of our ears. But, if you look at the global picture, that's not going to be the case in future.
Let's go to Indiana, Pennsylvania. Bruce is with us on Coast to Coast, east of the Rockies. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
If one country wanted to attack another using a nuclear device, wouldn't they just have to use a electromagnetic pulse? And in the United States, 90% of the population would be gone in 1 year. I heard that on this show.
Yep.
I'll take your answer off the line.
Well, there's no question. You don't have to blow up buildings anymore. You just shut down power grids and systems like that. And a population like we have now that is so dependent on the grid, we're in trouble. The same thing will happen when if an X flare ever hit us. I mean, that's very possible, too. All out there. I heard you breathe there, Julian.
Yep. George, I'd like to comment on that,
yeah,
if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Years ago, I was the first Western journalist to get into the nuclear disaster site at Chernobyl after the explosion. And the reason I went in there was I wanted to find out whether it is possible to restore a food supply after you've had a nuclear disaster. And there was a scientist there doing research into whether you can grow crops in irradiated soil, radioactive soil and water and fertilizer and so on. And the answer is that you probably just about can, but it's very difficult. It depends what all the nasty radioactive elements are in the fallout. But it's going to be very, very hard, was basically his answer. And this was a very important scientific discovery, because at the time it was one of the factors that persuaded, I think, both certainly the Russian and possibly also the American defense establishments, that there weren't going to be any winners in a nuclear confrontation. And this is something that the world needs to take on board. You know, as we move into this more dangerous era where more countries may get nuclear weapons, that if they start spraying these things around, they will really damage their own food supplies as well as those of other people.
Well, that's true. Let's go to Vista, California. Victor, west of the Rockies. Hey, Victor.
Hi, how's it going?
Okay.
I have a couple of questions real fast.
Sure.
Coming up on the hour. Number one, you were talking about long-range possibilities of famine. But because of the loss of Russian production in Pakistan and I think parts of China have been flooded, could we be facing a real food shortage in the next year or two? Is that a possibility? And also, if we went vegan, I'm not a vegan, but I mean, if we did, would that make it more likely we would have enough food? And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right. Vegan?
Yeah, you want me to comment?
Yeah. Well, yes, please.
Yeah. Look, I think you've got difficulties persuading people to be vegan. Human beings have been meat eaters since the dawn of time, and you're never going to get a lot of consensus on that. So I'm arguing we just have slightly more vegetables in the diet. But yes, technically, you could, the world food supply would go a lot further. If we were all mainly eating vegetables. And the example, really, the classic example is India, where the Indian diet is primarily vegetable diet. But now we've got this massive economic growth and all the IT industries and things roaring ahead. People are starting to buy much more meat than ever before. And in China, likewise, they have tripled their meat consumption. It's still only a third that of the United States per head, but it's tripled. So the danger is that all of these emerging societies will eat massively more meat, and this is what's going to really affect the resources that we've got to grow food worldwide.
Text message in from Julie from New York wants to know, what do you think about just juicing to conserve food and be healthier? Well, I guess anything helps. I don't know if juicing would feed the planet, though.
I'm not enough of a nutritionist to know what the answer is there. I suspect that you need some fiber and some solid stuff in your diet, and a lot of people wouldn't be satisfied just eating juice. But juice obviously is the extract, the best things in the food.
See, I think some companies like Monsanto, Julian, have pinpointed the fact that we're going to need food, there's going to be a crisis, and they'll have the lock on the seeds and they'll be very successful during that situation.
Well, this is one of the things that worries me, that there are patents being taken out now on the particular genes that are going to be most in need to cope with climate change. All our farmers around the world are going to have to cope with more uncertainties, more rain, less rain, whatever it is, and they're going to need new kinds of crops to do that. But if those crops are patented, that means the seed is going to be much more expensive, and it may not be readily accessible to them. And if I can give you an example.
Let's do that when we come right back. We've got another final hour to go on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take more questions, and also, if any of you have ever been just truly starving, share that story with us if you've ever had one of those episodes, whether you were stuck out there in some campground, whatever. I'd love to hear from that. We'll be back.